My name's Scott Redman. I'm an alcoholic. And you sure haven't heard me enough today. That was so funny when I said 22 years, and I was just off in my land. And these faces kind of swung around me, which has never happened. And I thought I should have just looked at you and said, I drank at dinner. And I... but then I would have won, and I would have, you know, congratulations on winning the contest. I hope you never win again. It is like being voted most attractive man on your cell block. It's an honor. I've been at conferences where guys get really excited about having the least amount of time, which I always think is kind of, I'm closer to death than anybody here. And they're giving me a book. But I'm really glad you're here. I'm really, really glad you're here. My hope for anybody who's new is that they, on some level, start to understand the enormity of the opportunity that's been afforded you. Because if you're new and you're not drinking, if you're taking the whooping and you're not drinking, if you're actually accepting your alcoholism and you're not treating it with a drink, because if the craving comes up and I drink, I'm treating my alcoholism with a drink. And it works. Unfortunately, it kills me, but it does work. And if you're not drinking, then you've made the decision on some level to stop treating your own alcoholism. And what I'm doing, in fact, I call it the serenity prayer for alcohol, you know. I'm stopping, I'm accepting the fact that I've got a craving, and I'm accepting the craving without treating it. I'm not treating it with a drink. I'm saying, Pop, I'm having a craving, I'm going to accept the craving, and I'm going to take the whooping. In hopes that this obsession gets removed. But the obsession can't possibly get removed if I won't accept the craving. And if you're new and you're not drinking, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. The not drinking part is a moose. You know, if it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much, much bigger organization. There's no question about it. We just would. It's this damn not drinking thing. You know, it screws a lot of people up. There would not be an empty seat in this room if it wasn't not for the non-drinking thing, you know? It's like a lot of things. A lot of people want the deal in AA, but it's the not-drinking thing, you know, that continues. So if you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to AA. And if you're a crack monster or... That's scary, crack monster. I'd like to welcome all the tweakers, if there are any tweakers here. Glad you're here. Love you guys. They stay real quick for a long time, you know. Every part of their face is moving in a different direction. I love you guys. You spook easy, too, tweakers. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you've ever masturbated till you're dehydrated, welcome to AA. We're glad you're here. I'd apologize for that, but I'm not sorry. I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming real close, but I'm not making fun of you. I'll tell you why I'm really not making fun of you. I don't care what you got. I don't care if you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, if you're a dope Goliath, if you're a dope Olympian. I just don't care. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. And I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did not have alcoholism when I came to AA. For a lot of reasons. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. You know, they just don't, because it might dull the pain. And you don't want to squander any agony opportunity, you know. And in addition to the Judaism, I couldn't possibly have been alcoholic because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. And as I said today, I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I have no beef with therapy. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. Boy, I wonder what that means. That's mystical. If you need a doctor, go get one. You know, if you have mental disease. It's an interesting thing. A problem in our society, I believe one of our problems is a lot of therapy, the model for a lot of therapy has swung to behavioral therapy and behavioral modification through medication. It's just true. This is not something I'm making up. It's just true. And because medication is prescribed so much, there's so much of it, I have found as a sponsor, because I don't tell people what to take and what not to take, I have no malpractice insurance at all. And if I get some, maybe I'll start doing that, but I don't have any, you know. But a lot of it's pretty clear to me. If you're taking drugs that affect the central nervous system, Valium, Thorazine, that kind of stuff, that's like pouring honey on your senses. And there's a problem being sober when you're taking stuff that affects your central nervous system, you know. If you're taking painkillers because you think eventually you might be in pain, and you're planning on being pain at a certain date, and you figure you'll just ramp up for the sucker, that's a problem. I got to tell you the story. I was talking to Brent before. I have alcoholic thinking. And no, really. And it's a terrible thing. And I still have this kind of thinking. It's why I do more in AA at 22 years than I ever did before. I've been hanging out with people who do, when things get good, they do more. When things get bad, they do more. They just do more, you know. And because without it, my alcoholism will go below the horizon, and I will act without reason and without sense. And untreated, I will do that today. So I was 19 years sober, and I had to get this biopsy. They're going to put a 6-inch needle in my side. And I said, what? And the doctor said, well, you know, we'll give you something to relax you. I said, good. You know, my sponsor had told me, he said, if I get hit by a truck, do not read me the 12 and 12. Get me some dope. That's what God made it for. We'll read spiritual literature after I've stopped foaming at the mouth from being hit by the truck, you know. So at any rate, I talked to my sponsor, told him about the biopsy, this, that. They're going to relax me. He said, fine, we're good, because I don't put a pill in my mouth or don't go through anything without committing it to my spiritual advisor. I just don't do it. I don't do any of this alone. And I understand why people go out when they do this by themselves. You know, I don't put a pill in my mouth without someone else involved. And I don't take drugs because I think I'm going to feel a certain way at some other time. At any rate, so I go to, it's an outpatient thing. This is about 3 years ago. I'm 19 years sober, right? And I check in. I said, the lady, you know, I was told that I was going to get relaxed. And she said, well, you know, they do it in there. So I go in there and they take my clothes. And I said, I was, you know, do you do the relaxing thing? Because I was told I was going to relax. And she said, no, but they'll be in. So a guy comes in and puts a line in my arm, and I figure this is obviously the moment of relaxation. And I said, you know, by the way, I was told that I was going to get relaxed. And the guy says, well, they do that downstairs. So I go downstairs, and they put me on this table, and I said, well, move this way, move that way. I said, I'm not moving anyway. All right? I was told that I was going to get relaxed. I am not relaxed in any way, shape, or form. And I have been promised relaxation. I'm not relaxed. And nobody's put 6 inches worth of needle in me unless I am really relaxed. So there's a lot of eye rolling, you know, which I don't like. I don't like the eye rolling. When you're on the business end of it, I don't mind rolling my eyes, but I don't like the eye rolling, you know. And they go get the doctor. The doctor comes in, and I go, you know, and he says, I can't give you anything. If I give you, you have to react. Respond. When I have that needle in you, you got to breathe or I can nick one of your vital organs. I said, 11 people have told me I'm going to get relaxed. What the hell are you talking about? He said, well, I'll tell you why they said that to you. I said, why? He said, because you look insane. And he said, no one's been willing to say no to you. You know, they're too busy. They got stuff to do. So they're just going, send the big Jew down there, you know, and let them worry. Let someone down there put up with what the hell's going to happen when someone says no to this guy. So at any rate, 3 weeks ago, I get told that I'm going to get this same deal. And so I already know what's going to happen. And my doctor tells me, and I say, look, can I call the doctor who's going to do this? Because I just got to tell him I'm afraid. I've had this, and it's incredibly painful. It's not like I shouldn't have been relaxed. I mean, it was one of the most painful things. It was like getting shot in the side. So I called the doctor up, and I'm on the phone with him, and I said, you know, look, I know you can't, you know, give me narcotics. And he said, of course I can. I said, what? He said, yeah, I'll give you something to relax you. I said, you got to be kidding me. So at any rate, it's, things have come full circle. So I committed to Brent. I'm going to have this thing at 7:30 Monday morning. I've committed to Brent. I'm not going to show up at 6 o'clock seeing if I can get some early relaxation, you know. And then maybe by the time they did it, they'll have to do it again. Because at any rate, I won't be doing that. I had this surgery 2.5 years ago where they did this incredibly invasive surgery on my back. And I know enough people who have taken Vicodin and gone out to know that I need to be extremely vigilant and alarmed about this stuff. And I also know that I don't need to be in mind-boggling pain. So I had a guy counting my pills, a guy looking over my pills, two guys who took calls for me during the day anytime I needed to take a pill. And I talked about every one of them that I took. And I got through it just fine. And I'm really glad I took those pills. They drilled 4.5 inches down into my vertebrae and put a bunch of screws and stuff. It was really funny when I went in, and I'm 20 years sober at this time, and this doctor puts my I had been in a lot of pain for a long period of time, and I go to this doctor, and this heavily accented Russian woman takes a picture of my spine. And she puts it in a box, and she's looking at my picture, and she goes, oh, no. I said, oh, no? What do you mean, oh, no? She said, no disc. Disc gone. Done. No disc. I said, how does such a thing happen? She said, bad luck. Bad luck? At any rate, I go inside. The guy says, you're on the brink of losing the use of your legs and having kidney failure. And what we're going to do is we're going to open you up from the front, move your vital organs aside. We'll have a cardiologist there to make sure that you don't die. And we're going to work directly into the spine, do a triple fusion, get some cadaver cartilage. And by now I'm going, la, 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 la. I kind of mind you're in any of this stuff. My name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a little punchy, I'm a little tired, and I got lost in Surgeryville. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City to a crazy family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met them. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. And I wish I was lying about this, because I'm from a long line of morons. And these are my people. This is my genetic pool. So there's not a lot of good news here. And if you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and he used to get free bales of steel wool. You know, like, here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all of them with the free steel wool. Now, it's like the Addams Family. I mean, it's just, you know, they're cutting the blossoms off roses. These people are insane. After a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, the whole room was like a living, pulsing, breathing organism. They were psycho. There was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts and mental and physical abuse. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news for you, because my family had nothing to do with making me an alcoholic. Because if they had, then I'd be in pretty damn good shape, because I had good therapy for all those years. And I could have worked out my family problems in therapy, and I'd be all right. I'd be able to drink. But my problem is way worse than that, you know. And I'm not telling you my family didn't make me an alcoholic, because I have a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy that makes it impossible for me to stop, and I developed this horrible spiritual cancer that almost killed me, that completely baffled me, completely befuddled me, and cut me out from the society of other people. And I'm not saying that my family didn't injure me. I was terribly injured as a kid, and I'm not telling you I haven't had to do a bunch of stuff because of that, and I have, you know. One of the things that happens to me when I sponsor a guy and he's on psychotropic drugs, I mean psychotropic drugs meaning drugs that are not affecting your central nervous system. They're affecting your adrenal system. Zoloft, Cyniquan, Paxil. There's a whole bunch of them. Wellbutrin. There's tons of them. One of the things that I love to ask a guy is, what is your diagnosis? Do you have mental disease? Most of them don't have a diagnosis. They've just been prescribed these drugs. I think that's a shame. I think it's a shame to be prescribed a drug that alters your psyche so much, and you without, I think it's criminal to tell you the truth. Now, if you've got depression, well, I've got depression. A lot of people have depression. If you have bipolar disease, if you have serious pathology, if you're schizoid, if you're any number of things, you have real mental disease, and that should be treated by all means. Now, I have sponsored men who have gotten off these drugs, but one of the really interesting things, again, is what is your diagnosis? And when a guy says, my diagnosis is, well, that's great. That's great information. I am telling you, it's a fraction of the men that I've dealt with actually have a diagnosis. And the ones that do have a diagnosis, they really need to be on these drugs. I have men I sponsor who I don't know where they would be if they weren't treating their mental illness. They certainly wouldn't be in AA helping other people. That's for damn sure. And again, I have no malpractice insurance at all. So I was terribly injured. It's funny, right before I got sober, I went to a psychiatrist and he said, I want to get you on some drugs. And I said, you know what? Actually, I'm okay on drugs. Got lots of drugs. Matter of fact, would you like some drugs? Because I got drugs up the wazoo here. I was kind of thinking I told my therapist I wanted to take less drugs, which I think is just hysterical. I would like to take less drugs. Can you imagine somebody actually helping you do that? Let's cut your heroin intake in half. Let's just knock half the heroin off. How much heroin are you taking every week? Let's try to cut that down. At any rate, I started drinking at a really young age, and I have the allergy, and I've got it bad, and it started really early. I tried to get into a gang when I was a kid. I failed gang. I was hanging out with some kids. In those days, and for those of you as ancient as me, you'll recall there, Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes used to have a ignition on the column that said off, on, and lock. So I was being brought into this group of brilliant young men who were stealing cars and having demo derbies. Really upward movement in this group. This is really a bunch of geniuses. And stealing cars, just smashing them into each other. And there's a ring of guys around me. This guy George is bringing me into the group. He said, look, if the car's on all, knock out the fly window. This is when there were fly windows. Get into the car. And if it's on off, put your house key in the car and turn it on and drive away. You could do that. He said, if it's on lock, shine it and get another car. And I looked around the circle. I kind of wanted to make my bones. And I said, what if it's on? He said, then someone's in the car, you moron. And I failed gang 101. I was... And there was a hippie recruiting station across the street, and there was no paperwork at all. They let me in. There were just no questions at all. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement at all. They just can't get a claw in the rug, you know? They just can't do it. I overcame that pot problem with pills, and... I kicked that pill problem with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I overcame that gall-darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. Then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And and alcohol was on the table every day. My friend Carl M. says this thing that I just love. It's about drugs and AA. He says, why do we go to a speaker meeting where a guy says, well, I was imprisoned. I uh, was imprisoned. I was sodomized by men. I sodomized other men. And now I'm sorry, but I'm going to talk about drugs. it's very funny to me. But at any rate, I was in a cycle where I was using intravenous drugs, and I talked about it this afternoon. My father had a massive heart attack, and I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night that he died, and it was just one of those horrible nights where I got it. I got how bad it was. I got what a pig, what an animal I had become. And I couldn't fit the pain in my head. I couldn't bear it. I couldn't show up for him. I couldn't even go give him a kiss, you know. And I had to do some really fast work in my head because I couldn't be that guy. I couldn't be the animal who couldn't be there for his dad. And I came up with it quick. It was needles and heroin, and all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be that guy. I'd be another guy, but I wouldn't be that guy. And I didn't, not for 13 years. Didn't touch the stuff. And shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play in New York. I got to do some really incredible stuff a time. I never got to do any of it more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business, so I couldn't find it again, you know. And this new usherette with long brown hair walked in. I took one look at her and walked into the dressing room of this play and got up on a chair and said, if anybody talks to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'll break all the bones in your hands and feet. And we started a life together. We hadn't even talked. And we had a great time. Great time in New York. Early 20s, acting on Broadway. We just had a fantastic time. We didn't know that we were just a couple of dogs trying to run on linoleum. And Nancy got very ill from prolonged exposure to me. And we had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers in the house. I came home one night, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine into this cup. And I turn around, and my wife's giving me her pre-Al-Anon rat face. And I said, what? And she said, what are you doing? And I looked at her in the eye, and I said, I'm having a glass of wine. Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? I was having a beaker of wine, is what I was having. Having a vino big gulp. And the alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Our beautiful son Micah was born, and we were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. He was really welcomed into our community, you know. And just 2 years and 9 months after that, when our son Jesse was born, nobody came to the hospital. There were no phone calls, no flowers. We had become completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be around us, you know. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise. And that night, Jesse was sick. He had a transitive tachypnea of the heart and wound up in neonatal intensive care. And I got a call from the hospital that night. And this doctor, who I'd never met before, said, your wife's all alone. Now, you guys know, you might know, there's no better way to be in a hospital than on the maternity ward when things are okay. It's a wonderful place. A lot of warmth, a lot of celebration. People are really being invited into their community. There's a sense of family. I'm not saying as a rule, but in general, you know. And there's not many places worse than when you've got a life that's like a tiny little awfully painful paper cut. And this doctor said, your wife's in psychological duress. Your baby's sick. There's no one here. Where are you? And I said, you know what? I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son. Micah was 2-9 at the time. And this doctor, who I had never met before, said something pretty remarkable to me. She said, you know what? And this is a big metropolitan hospital. She said, my husband's home. I'll give you my address and my phone number. You can take your son to my house, and my husband will watch him, so you can come down here. And I said, no. I couldn't. I had no tools to accept this woman's generosity. That's how thick the ice around my heart had become. It was the terrible night my son was born. Wow, what a thing to say. And it's the truth. It was the terrible night my son was born. It was part of my terrible days. And little were we to know from that awful night that it was going to continue for 3 more years. Bill talks about it so beautifully in his story. You know, he talks about stealing from his wife's purse when she comes home, being too much of a coward to swallow poison, dragging his mattress down to the bottom floor of his brownstone so he wouldn't pitch himself out the window. And he says, little were we to know it was going to continue for X more years. You know, you think you hit it, you think you're sucking the steely bottom of your life, and you just take a shovel out. A little were we to know it was going to continue for 3 more years. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22nd, 1985, our sons were 6 and 3. My wife was a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot from prolonged exposure to me. I was dying. My careers in show business were gone. And a couple of years before I got sober, Micah was 4 or 5 years old. And he came to me. We had this Christian family move next to us, and their son used to talk about God in just a lovely way. In that lovely way, a familiar way. God was part of this kid's life. People talked about God in this kid's home. He had a relationship, a very open, free, relaxed relationship, talking about God. And my son Micah came to me at about 5, and he said, Dad, is there anything such as God? And I looked into the eyes of my perfect baby boy, and I said, no, he should have been taken from me. I don't think there's any higher form of child abuse. I never laid a hand on him that I can remember. I don't remember everything. But I know I crippled my kids pretty good. I thought I was saving him some skin so he wouldn't have to be played like a sap or a sucker by those yo-yos out there. I gave him the real existential party line, something every 5-year-old is famished for. And I lied to him. I lied to him. I stood in the presence of all this immutable law, all this poetry underlying everything. And I said, I don't know. No. No. Even worse than that, I told a baby, in essence, you know when it's dark and you're terrified and you can't go to sleep? Tough, because that's all there is. That's really the message. That's the horrible message. This crazy idea that I'm separate. Crazy idea. And if I don't find, and that's my ego, if I don't make sure I'm separate, I'm going to get annihilated. I'm going to get sucked up. I'm going to disappear. I'm not going to be part of. I'm not going to be part of the connective tissue. You know, I was talking about fellowship before. And to me, fellowship is the freedom to move in and out of contact with my brothers and my sisters with a sense of freedom, no attachment, no craving, and wearing it like a loosely fitting garment, and being able to move in and out of that almost effortlessly, because it's not about us. It's not personality. The love is not personality specific. It can't be, you know. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. And my world came crashing down around me. Now, I want to tell you, that's a mystery to me. Because many other days, I just would have made it okay to put a needle in my arm again. I just would have moved the whole world. I used to sponsor this guy. I sponsored him for about 15 minutes. And he was married. He was a male prostitute. And he had a gay lover. And he called me to tell me he drank, and I said, why? And he said, I caught my wife cheating on me. He was a male prostitute, he had a gay lover, and he drank because his wife cheated on him. Now, unfortunately, I understand that. And what I mean by that, you got to move the whole world to make that happen. You got to move the whole world. You got to cut and paste reality. You got to move the whole world to somehow, in that landscape. So I understand why was it not okay for me to pick up the needle again? It's a mystery to me, an absolute mystery to me. But my world came crashing down around me. I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, and I told him what I had done. And he said to me, I didn't know it at the time, but he said to me virtually the exact same thing that Carl Jung told a guy named Roland Hazard. He was an American millionaire who was dying from alcoholism. His family had the wherewithal to send him to Switzerland to be analyzed by one of the fathers of modern psychology, Carl Jung. That's a pretty great prescription to get, you know. And Jung analyzed the guy, and the guy drank right after. And when Roland Hazard came back to Jung, devastated that this happened, Jung said, you know, the only thing I can suggest is we institutionalize you or you hire a bodyguard. You know, that's all we can do. And Jung said, is there nothing else? And Hazard said, is there nothing else? And Jung said, you know, there have been examples of alcoholics of your description having spiritual rearrangements. Jung had an idea called the collective consciousness. We call it the group conscience. As God presents in the group conscience. Right? Jung called it the collective conscience. He had such a beautiful, Jungian therapists, many of them have a beautiful idea about a spiritual community, you know. And Jung said to this guy, I've been trying to bring about such a change in you and I have failed. And Hazard said, well, you know, I'm in my church. It'll be okay. And again, Jung said, I wish that that was enough. And I'm really talking about a rearrangement. And Roland Hazard went out and got himself a spiritual rearrangement in a group called the Oxford Group. Carried the message to the guy who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. So it was a direct line from Carl Jung. I didn't know that at the time, but at the time my therapist said, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. Well, first he said, the only thing I can suggest is that we institutionalize you. Now, on most other days, I'm good for the institution. That's fine with me. That's better than dental surgery. That's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. I'm good with that. We're good all day and all night with that. And then he said the thing that Jung couldn't say. He said, or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. I absolutely couldn't tell you. But I went there. And I went into this meeting in the deep San Fernando Valley in a group called Unit A, and I took one step into the room, and I looked around, and I said, oh, my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics Anonymous. How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked like it was the product of 200 years of inbreeding to me. I mean, it just, there were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, or so it seemed to me. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle, you're a miracle, it's a miracle, big miracle. Oh, the furniture, the coffee's a miracle. It's just a miracle, miracle, miracle. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to break out. You know, I know that's going to start. Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Then the AA unsolicited advice guy, he got me at the end of the meeting. You know him. He's wearing a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No, but thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Clyde. I'll come back next week. We'll hook a rug, you know. Do I bring my own bib overalls? Am I issued a pair? Let's just die. Let's just die right now. I hated everything about that man. My skin crawls. I felt my DNA unraveling. I just couldn't believe it, you know. And I went back to that group every morning for a year. And because I was out of plans. I just was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan, and it's the single most utilized plan that I've seen in all this time, is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. That's out there. That's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually. That sucker's out there. Gets a little more popular the closer you get to Lee Trevino Boulevard, I think. It's good. What town is that in again? Thank you. El Paso. When I shared that in El Paso, a lot of people looked at their feet when I talked about the one more dope deal to set yourself up financially for sobriety. And I was out of plans. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and got a sponsor named Ruby, who's a gorgeous, adorable woman who I adore. And it's still Nancy's sponsor, and I love this woman more, I can tell you. She never did anything but love me, you know. We used to go to their house, and I'd just be radioactive. I felt like there was no skin on me, and I'd look around this house with all these people bringing food and having fun. You know the house. If you've been to that house, you know that house. And I'd stand there and think, you know, this is so, I'm so happy for them, you know, but we're just too busted up. We had these crazy rules for our kids. You know, they couldn't eat sugar, cuss, or watch TV. So my wife would give them a good health food breakfast and put them in the car with me, Dr. Death, you know. Say, hope you live. You've had your granola. You're ready for your adventure now. With Psycho Dad, you know, who is either drunk, planning on getting drunk, hungover, or pissed off that he's not drunk. It's one of the four. There's not a lot more colors on the palette, you know. And Nancy would take him over to Ruby, and Ruby would give him a big bowl of M&Ms, turn on the TV, put on the Love Boat, and I'm going to cuss twice. I apologize in advance. And Ruby would say, boys, if you say thanks, you get more shit. You go, wow, chocolate TV and cursing. This is like, it doesn't get any better than this. This is fantastic. And because, you know, you got a lot of rules. When you can't control the central piece, you try to put lipstick on the pig. You try to control the rest of the deal, you know. And Ruby's husband, Milton, who at the time I think was 7 years sober, he's at over 30 years now. And Milton called the boys over when they were little boys. And I want to tell you, my son Jesse's 25. My wife asked him for some a couple months ago, and he said, you know, Mom, if you say thanks, you get more shit. And Milton had the boy. He motioned him over. This is my last cuss. And he bent down and he whispered to them, boys, your parents don't know shit. And the kids went, oh, my God, we've suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is, like, fantastic. And there's more cursing and chocolate. This is so great. They love going to Ruby's house. One time, Micah was eating chocolate and watching TV, and he said to Nancy, I love this program. It's just wonderful, wonderful. We needed to be lightened up. We were flat and gray and wooden. We needed you to pry our jaws open and breathe some life into us. And we made a beginning. You guys said don't get involved in your first year, and we didn't. We stayed the hell away from each other. I had nothing to bring to my marriage at all. I either screamed until she shut up or I cried until she shut up. I like to loom. I'm a loomer. I'm big. I like to loom with a light behind me so I get her in a shadow. I've always liked that. It's like Total Eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right in the pocket there. That's the Scott Redmond Relationships Workshop right there. Scream, cry, loom. There you go. Talk to her until she changes her mind. That's it. Just talk to her until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over. And on the way down, she goes, oh, okay, and then just falls over. That's my communication skills at that time. I'm not trying to bring anything to the deal. I'm very sick. And I stuck around for 6 months, and I knew I was going to drink because I had seen the drill hundreds of times in just 6 months. People came in and changed and did the work. People came in and didn't change, didn't do the work, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, shared their hess right out the door, or just stayed here and became columns of human sewage and sexual predators, although I judge no man. But you know that because I've said it so many times today. And I knew I was going to drink. And my kids had become less frightened of me. And I had one of the horrible things I remembered was some months before I got sober, I was hungover and I was with my older son who was 6 at the time, and I got sick in front of him from being hungover. And my son saw me get sick and it made him sick and he got sick in front of me. And the horrible, it was just again one of those moments where I got it, where I stood still long enough to appreciate the horror of what had happened. My son got sick not because he had eaten bad food, not because he had the flu. It was because he was with me. He was with his father, and that was the only reason that he got sick. And I don't know that it taught me anything, but I know that it created a window of opportunity for me, you know. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. Good guy, really great guy, still is a great guy. And he made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA, and he invited me to his house, and he read me chapter 5. And on the way through, he took me through the first 2 steps. We read step 3 and said a prayer on our knees. And then he went back, and he gave me instructions on how to do a 4th step in the big book of AA. And I will tell you that I stopped feeling like I was stealing someone's chair here. Anytime I'm at a step study and somebody shares and they say, well, I've never worked this step, but I always wonder, but what? What exactly are you going to be talking about? It's about this step. You've already told us you haven't worked the step, but at any rate, because of my non-judgmentalness, it doesn't bother me at all. So it's not it's a problem for lesser developed spiritual people. At any rate, I was working the steps, so I actually could participate, felt part of. The conversation and the reading took on new meaning for me because it was backed up by practical experience. You know, it's that old thing you hear in 1,000 meetings, and for me it's been so true. I read the big book after having certain experiences, and all of a sudden they changed the book. You know, there's all this stuff that leaps out of me because if there was ever a non-intellectual pursuit, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. If there was ever a hands-on treatment based on personal experience, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never seen anything like it, you know, certainly in no other medical treatment that I've ever seen in my life. I did my inventory in 3 months. I went and I read it to my sponsor. I did step 6 and 7, which I got so enjoyed talking about this afternoon, about how it's really become the fulcrum for my working, breathing, developing relationship with my higher power. And I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do about it. My kids were down there, my dad was down there, and I didn't know what the heck I was going to do about it, and I didn't have a sponsor who was going to tell me. And he said, just do your job in AA. And as I told you, my boys were really busted up, you know. And I had to do some really embarrassing stuff I didn't want to do. I had to go into their school and advocate for them. It was really embarrassing because they were in bad shape. And sometimes my sons were and are extremely intelligent, and they tested way, their IQ is just way up there. And for some teachers, it's very disheartening and very frustrating because they were so sick that some of the teachers, a few of the teachers, were angry at my sons for squandering a gift that they felt that of some other kids who tried real hard but who didn't have the capability, that it was being wasted on my sons. That if it was in the hands of these other kids who found themselves wanting with intelligence but had the industry. You know, one teacher said, I just want to shake them. I just want to grab them and shake them. And I said to her, you know what? We're all shook. We need help. Can you help us? My sons are really sick because they've been living with me and I've been really sick. And we are making a beginning. Can you help us? And not one time did anyone say no. I mean, there were teachers who were difficult and angry at my kids and not interested in helping, but the institution helped. And they said, absolutely, we'll test the boys. The boys got tested and they needed help. It was for real. Their small motor stuff was messed up. They couldn't put together small tasks. And there was nothing organically wrong with them. They were scared all the time. This fear was so disruptive that they couldn't even put small tasks together after a while, you know. And I didn't know. I hadn't read our literature. I didn't read about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. And if you don't think that you've affected anybody in your alcoholism, maybe you drank in a cave. Maybe you drank in a Ziploc bag. I don't know. I didn't. I unfortunately was in contact with a lot of people. And they got special ed. And the special ed teachers said, let's get him into music. Let's get him into sports. Let's see if some of the big motor stuff will shake down and impact some of the small motor stuff. And Jesse wanted to play drums. And I didn't have any money. Drums cost a lot of money. But my kid said he wanted to play drums. I went to the music store. And I bought him a drum pad. Drum pad is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber on it and a couple of sticks. My kid had expressed a desire to do something, and I had backed him up just with a couple of booze bucks. That's all I had. And I went back to my home group, and I told the guys what I had done. For the same reason, if you've got that kind of home group, you would too. I wasn't bragging. They were really interested in my family. They were really rooting for us. They wanted to know. They were really interested in us. And I told them what happened. And I was really proud of myself, I spent a couple of dope dollars to get my kids into the Little League. We had become uncivilized. We tried to do that a couple of times, but, you got to drive the kid and pay attention and get places on time, and we ran out of gas. So get him into the Little League, first game I went to, my wife comes to the game and she looks over in the stands. There's everybody in the stands and there's me alone in the sun going just insane, just going up and down two hat sizes. I got a vein on my forehead pumping like a garden hose, I'm here, I'm doing my job, I'm here. The kids are thrilled, they're looking and going, Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man. Look at that. That's unbelievable. And you know what? It took me a couple of years until the voices diminished in volume and number until I just got to go sit in the stands with the people, just to be at my sobriety station, just to go and sit down and be at my sobriety station. And a couple of years after I did that, my son Jesse received one of the great compliments a human being can receive, I believe, on this planet. He was intentionally walked. Now, if you're a fan, you know that that means that they're scared of you and they want to get to the weenie behind you. And he didn't want to jump up and down and be a geek. And he just laid down his bat. He trotted up the first baseline. And on the way up the first baseline, he looked at me and he just shot me just a little bit of stuff. It's the old man. You don't want to be lame. Don't spoil him, And I could have missed the whole thing. I'm not telling you that my son Jesse got intentionally walk because I'm sober. I'm telling you, I was at the game because I'm sober. And I've been with enough guys who have been drunk on their kid's birthday again, and I tell them about the day my son got walked because I was there. I was lucky enough to be there. I could have been had to work too, but I was lucky enough to be there at my sobriety station. And I told the guys in the group that I got Jesse this drum pad, and there were a lot of burnout drummers in our group at that time. And like within 3 months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. And they're like, these guys showing up with these Megadeth drums, dude. Jesse had a drum set that when he sat behind, he disappeared. You couldn't even see him. Hear this little voice going, 1, 2, 3. Gigantic drum set. And Micah, same thing happened with Micah around keyboards and stuff like that. And some years ago, I got to go to the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip in L.A. and see my kids burn the dump down. Just walk out on the stage of the House of Blues in the heart of Hollywood, playing to this packed room, 800-900 kids playing hip-hop music elbow to elbow, and burnt the dump down. And over to the side, there's this group of middle-aged weeping alcoholics. The kids are kind of going, what is with the crying old people, man? That is kind of creepy, And they look like they've been around the block a few times, too. It's a little odd. And that's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around. At that time, it was for about 17 years, I was about a year sober, I started sponsoring a guy named Roland. And I still sponsor him. I've sponsored him for 21 years. And he used to call our house every night, and he'd leave a message on our machine. He'd say, "Scott, it's rolling. I'm sober. I love you. Good night." And he'd hang up. And about 5 years later, my son Micah came to me, and he said, "You know, Dad, I should tell you that when I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the machine." And this was the kid I said there was no God to. I told him there was no God. I tried to rip God out of his life. And you guys came in over the answering machine. You tucked him in every night. And I think some nights he stayed up till he passed out because he was so scared. But there was one thing that he knew. He absolutely knew. He knew that Roland wouldn't call me if I was drunk. That he knew. He knew that Roland was calling me as the man that was helping him. And he knew that Roland wouldn't call me if I was drunk. And he knew everything was okay and he'd go to sleep. And we don't even know what we're doing half the time when we do it, you know. It's just absolutely remarkable when you throw a pebble in the pond. Now, I was sober about a year. I was kind of becoming a spiritual Goliath at that time. And I had started sponsoring some guys and thinking about writing a few appendices to the Big Book of AA. And I was compiling my notes at that time and rewriting the chapters to the wives and a number of other things. And I got an overture made to me. I had a ghostwriting job at that time at 20th Century Fox. And I was being considered to have a staff directing job on a situation comedy at one of the major studios. And I thought, oh, my God, this is such a great opportunity for the program. Because if I get this job, it's just going to be so great for my sponsees because they'll see the program in action. They'll really see it working, you know, as I prosper thusly. And I did I directed one episode, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was humiliated. I went to this company picnic, and I was offered a beer by the producer, and I didn't come to that picnic to get any to bring anything. I was there to get something. And he said, "Hey, have you had one of these?" And I said no, and I took a beer and I walked away, and I said, "You're a dead man." I guess the wind hit my face. I said, "You're dead," and I put it down, and I walked away. I called my sponsor, and I told him what had happened, and he said to me, "Well, I guess that you have the show business God." And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, what keeps you sober?" I said, "God." He said, "Okay, God gets you sober, keeps you sober, and you didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly." Now, when I came into AA, I heard God getting people in relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces. And I went, "Oh, no, not the parking space, God. Not the parking space, God." And if you have a parking space, God, and he gives you a space, pass it on. Yeah. It's a funny thing. We got nailed in the Northridge earthquake really bad. We got really badly injured. We were at the epicenter. Our house got creamed. I got a bad physical injury. And shortly after the earthquake, we were at this AA function out of town, and this woman who used to live in Los Angeles walked up to me at the function, and she said, "Oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake." And I said, "Oh, so he likes you. He likes you, but wear crap, but he likes you." And she said to me, "I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." I'm out of here, man. I have no desire to stay sober in that world. I can't live in a world where I've got a God saying, "Get him. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. Get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Turn his wife to salt. Kill his goat. Put a finger in his eye. Get him. Smote his ass. Smote anyone he talks to. We'll figure it out later. It's lesson time." It's like God is some deranged game show host, you know? "Let's key your car. You're due for a rash. It's boils for you. And there's a reason. There's a reason for your rash. You'll figure it out later. Maybe." I can't live in that world. I can't. I believe the mystics. I believe the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. I believe St. Thomas, who says in his tract on mysticism and on faith, the first sentence is, "To know God is to not know God." Every time someone ascribes an intention or a personality to God, they take this incredible radiance, which my life is renewed by the power of daily, this mystery, and they make it this big. This big. Now, this mystery is something that used to terrify me, and it's something that if you try to take it away from me, I won't let you. I won't let you. I don't think that God killed Rachel Wang for a reason. I think Rachel Wang got really sick and she moved on. I don't think there's a beginning and an end to any of this. I can't live in that world. Is it true? I don't know. It's where I am with it. I want as much oxygen in my world as I can get. So when my sponsor said, you know what, I had to write the inventory, I was resentful of them for not giving me the job. See, my job, my God expects me to do my job in AA. My sons are 25 and 28. My older son, in 2 weeks, I'll go to Ithaca, New York, and watch him graduate the graduate school of Cornell University for public policy. My 25-year-old son is in, has received a 5-year fellowship to receive his doctorate in mathematics at Stanford. I cannot believe that this is because God likes us more than the people whose children have been annihilated. I will not live in that world. It's not a world that I'm even vaguely interested in. It's just what's happening in my house. My God expects me to do my job in AA if my children survive or if they don't. That's not an indication of God's love for me. My indication of God's love for me is how I move through that thing. I have dear, dear people in my life who are so important to me who have had that experience. And I have had the honor to watch them walk through that pain and that grace and that experience. You know, and boy, that's a big world. I like that world. I can live in that world. And my sponsor said, you know, when you do 6 and 7 on this 10-step, because I had to write those resentments against myself for almost drinking and all that stuff, he said, you better have a talk with your higher power about what the hell you're going to do. And I did. And in 6 and 7, after I read the inventory and read the fears and read the defects, I said, Pop, you got it. Take show business. I'll do anything. I will do I'm willing to do anything for a living, and I'm not going to make my sobriety contingent on that. Take show business. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God, and I said, I did not mean this. I didn't. We've had some kind of grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't even, like, on the long list. I don't know where the hell you came up with this. Now, in Los Angeles, when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, and you follow the group around, and you make them food. And it's a great job. You make a ton of dough. It's Teamster dough. You're on a movie set on a vehicle. You make a lot of money. But I'm Scott Redman, you know. And the first movie that I cooked on, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning, and he said, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? And he said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. This gift is so beautiful. And he said, sounds like you've got a resentment. Well, they go to workshops to learn this stuff, you know. I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A 5-bagger for sure. What are the defects? Well, I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along. I have false pride. I'm ungrateful. I'm working and I'm making a ton of dough. I'm a mind reader and a people pleaser. I'm greedy. I'm not trusting in God. And I wrote it and I read it. And then I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors, actors I had directed in soap operas, people who had been my stage managers, and I would come back to my group with a new tale of humiliation every week, and the guys would just go, oh, just tears streaming down their face, you know. And I got to help some guys who felt they had fallen from a height. They hadn't reached the top rank in AA, which is Child of God, you know. I had one friend named Paul who felt he had fallen from a height, and we did some work together and did the inventory and got straight with it. And he had this prayer. He'd say, Pop, I'm willing to do anything for a living, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. And I was, you know, I was just so glad to help him out. And I'll just tell you this one little quick sidebar. This guy who had been the star of the sitcom that I had not gotten the job on, I look up and he's walking in as a newcomer in AA. And I got some issues here. And I needed to get rid of them, and I did the inventory. And subsequently, he heard me share, and he asked me to help him in AA. And I asked him to come to my house, and he came over late. Now, on my inventory, my original inventory, when I was a little boy, between the ages of 5 and 10, there was a neighborhood bully named Mark. Mark used to kick my ass every day. He humiliated me at our first kind of mixer parties, spin-the-bottle parties, that kind of stuff. And he just used to wake up and say, "Where's Scott?" and come kick my ass. And I had about a dozen items on my inventory about this guy. Anyway, that's the Bronx. This is Los Angeles. This guy, the star of the sitcom, comes and he's late to my house so I can start him and I can bring him to God. We're going to move towards God together. I'm so good. God, I'm so good and so spiritually developed. And he comes and he says, "You know, geez, I'm sorry I'm late, but our new director..." My job, that's my job. It's a new director. That's the job that I should have had. "Our new director teaches an acting class. This guy, Mark..." And it's him. And now I'm going, get a hobby. You know what I mean? Take up knitting or something. But get off me, because this is... I mean, it was just too damn funny. And you know what? I didn't tell my buddy what was going on at the time. I waited years later, and I did tell him. We both laughed. I think he laughed a little harder than me. But I thought my sons and I would get close, you know, on Oscar buffing night, the night we would buff my awards. I thought that's when we would grow very intimate. And the fact is my kids wanted me to teach them how to cook. And Jesse and I have been cooking together for 20 years. And he still calls me, and I talk him through sauces, and it's one of the great joys in our life. I didn't know that that was going to happen. That's not the way I would have planned it. And I learned how to show up and give them a dime for their nickel, and I did a lot of 10-step work to fight off this feeling of humiliation. One day, when you're on this job, you do everything. You're the chef, you're the cleanup guy, and I walked around, and there's garbage all over me and garbage on the ground, and I see this guy, and he was the last assistant director I had when I directed a sitcom. And I went and I hid behind the truck. And you know, we all have those moments. I think we all have those moments. Many of us have those moments where God is truly everything or he's nothing. And I stood behind this truck and I said, "You know what, man? You're either going to hide behind this truck for the rest of your life, or you're going to go out there and do what a cook does on this job and clean up." And I went around, and Lenny was very happy to see me. He was very happy to see me. And I wiped my hand. I shook his hand. I said, "It's really good to see you." And I went and I cleaned up. And I want to tell you, man, I've been okay cleaning up since then. And I cooked for about 3 years, and I had this overture made to me by a company called Ketchum Public Relations, and it's a big-time comedy writing job. And you know, I'm telling you, if I got this job, it would be so good for the guys I sponsor. And I'll tell you why. Hold it. Because they would have seen me suffer, you know, through the loss. And now, right? You see what I'm talking about, right? So I had to do a videotape for these guys, and I went mad. I just, not living in today, just greed, the whole deal. And my brain blew up before I even found out about the job. I got straight. I wrote it. I read it to my sponsor. We had a good yuck. Maybe he laughed a little harder than me, but we had a good yuck, and I was cool. I had released it. And then I got a call from Ketchum that I didn't, and I had done a videotape for these guys, that I did not get the job. And I was good. And then I get a call to cater some commercials in the mountains above L.A., and I hop in the truck and get up there, and I grab the call sheet, which is this piece of paper that gives you all the information about the shoot, and I see that the commercials are for Ketchum Public Relations. So I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And I see a guy with a video camera at the base of the truck. He's taping me. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we're taping the making of the commercial." He's taping my humiliation. He's going to go back to New York with the tape and show it to him, and they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, that poor son of a bitch. So I go back to the hotel. I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, are we getting the gift? It's a miracle. It's a miracle, miracle, miracle. This is miraculous. It's a miracle. And my sponsor said to me, you know, I guess God had enough riders and he needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. I'm 22 years sober. I'm 55 years old. My blood pressure is 118 over 68. I've never been healthier. I've never felt more handsome. I've never felt more in my life. My life is changing. My career is changing. My home life is changing. I'm going to be moving where I live. Tremendous sadness, tremendous joy in my life. Nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous does it say the road gets narrower. I'm not condemning that. I understand what people are saying, that they can't do all the bad crap they used to do. I understand that. I don't subscribe to it. I love what the book says. It says, come join us on the broad highway. Become part of the big idea, the great reality. Help us pack things into the mainstream of life. Become part of, join us on the firing line of life. It only talks about life becoming more inclusive, not exclusive. It talks about a big, sexy, robust, living, breathing relationship with a higher power in you. When I see my friends here, when I see Brent, when I see Beverly and George, and now my new friends, the people who I adore, who I've met here today and have been so generous to me. And when I see them, I feel this tremendous connection. And the crazy idea, the friendship idea, is that when you remove us from that, if you take Brent and I out of that, is that the connection disappears. That's the crazy friendship idea. The fellowship says no. That connection is the face and the breath of God. That's the face of God. My alcoholism has not gone below the horizon in 22 years because it's bolstered on that connective tissue. If I can just breathe on the ember of that connective tissue and encourage it in some other way, I'm in the bonus round. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to urge you to get involved in the cycle of surrender and commitment so you can move out of the cycle of spree and remorse. The good news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. I don't know of any other treatment from a fatal illness where the text about the treatment contains the sentence, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says, cholera is a hoot. You'll love cholera. You'll meet other people with cholera. Then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. It just doesn't get any better than that. My sponsor used to say something so gorgeous. He used to say, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only recovery from a fatal illness that he knew of that leaves the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. Wow, how incredibly true. If you're new here, I want to urge you to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks, guys.